Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. In this program, we'll look at books, ideas, new research, intellectual currents, and cultural trends that can help us better understand what's happening in China's politics, foreign relations, economics, and society. Join me each week for in-depth conversations that shed more light and bring less heat to the way we think and talk about China. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you this week from Chicago, Illinois. Seneca is supported this year by the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national resource center for the study of East Asia. The Seneca podcast will remain free, but if you work for an organization that believes in what I'm doing with the podcast, please consider lending your support. You can get me at senecapod@gmail.com. And listeners, please support my work on Substack at seneca.substack.com. There you will find, in addition to the podcast, the complete transcript of the show, a weekly essay from me, and now a wide range of offerings: James Carter's This Week in China's History, Paul French's Ultimate China Bookshelf, Andrew Methvin's Chinese Phrase of the Week, the You Can Learn Chinese podcast from Jared Turner and John Pasden, and the outstanding China Global South podcast, as well as weekly essays from our friends at the China Global South Project. As I say each week in the intro, I am interested in how we think and talk about China. Every once in a while, I encounter someone with the same interest in examining our discourse on China, whether academic, you know, within the social sciences and history, say, or more broadly in media, in civil society, or just out there in the social media platforms that have now become, unfortunately, our de facto public sphere. Just in the last year, I have gotten to know Isa Ding, Associate Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University, author of The Performative State, Public Scrutiny, and Environmental Governance in China, and, for my money, one of the most original thinkers when it comes to, well, the way we think and talk about China. I had the great good fortune to spend a good amount of time with her and a couple of other folks, Kevin Xu and Cameron Johnson, both of whom you will meet on Seneca before too long. The four of us had participated in the Salzburg Global Seminar, and all happened to be headed to Vienna for a few days after, just to take in the sights. It was like a walking China salon, held between cafes, museums, and restaurants. I'm delighted to be here in Chicago, where I just spoke last night at the Chinatown Hall, put on by the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, organized here in Chicago by Isa, and it was a perfect opportunity to finally sit down and talk about her ideas on the discourse about China. Isa Ding, thank you so much for having me here in Chicago, and welcome to Seneca.
Thank you for having me on the Seneca podcast, Kaiser.
My absolute pleasure and honor. Let me start, Isa, by asking you about a concept that I first heard you drop almost casually, really. It was at a panel, an environmental panel, actually. It was about teaching about the environment in China, or teaching about environmentalism in China, and that was at the AAS conference in Boston in 2023. And I've mentioned it before on the show. You call it authoritarian teleology. That might strike some listeners as sounding a bit jargony, but really, it's a pretty simple idea. And once you've said it, once I heard you articulated. I feel like I see it instantiated just everywhere. So break it down for us. What is authoritarian teleology, and why is it such an unhelpful habit?
Authoritarian teleology is a style of thinking. It interprets everything an authoritarian government does as a strategy to stay in power. It has two features. First, a functionalist feature. Teleology is the explanation of something through its design purpose rather than the actual cause. Now, to be sure, sometimes the cause is the purpose and the purpose is the cause, and this happens a lot in biology.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Biology is where exactly where my mind went, because you see this kind of teleology and functionalism all the time when people say they see, you know, an organism has evolved this particular trait, and they think that it was like, you know, designed or deliberate, and it was like intentional, and then they interpret everything of that organism just in terms of, you know, its suitability to the environment. It drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, functional analysis is a legitimate method in biology, but it doesn't always work. So an example, why do giraffes have long necks?
Because it was evolutionarily advantageous to be able to reach into higher branches because of drier climates or something like that, that there was less foliage low on the ground for them to reach. And so the ones with longer necks tended to be able to, you know, take in more calories and reproduce more successfully. So that mutation just ended up kind of getting reinforced, right?
Well, that's what biologists thought. Then they discover, actually a Chinese biologist discovered, that giraffes actually develop long necks for use in fighting. And after they got the long necks, they started to eat leaves on tall trees. So we have to say right off the bat that even when scientists use functional analysis, they can still get the function wrong.
Oh, wow.
But in the social sciences, the problem with functionalism is much worse. Where human behavior or organizational behavior is concerned, the cause and the purpose oftentimes do not agree. And the purpose and the actual outcome often do not agree. So I have an important talk today to give. So why did I stay up watching stupid TV shows last night? How does that serve today's function?
Right.
And so that's the first feature. And the second feature of authoritarian teleology is the assumption that the primary driver of an authoritarian regime is to stay in power or quote-unquote survive. And therefore, anything they do is to survive. And okay, this may be true, but we can never truly know if it's true or not so long as the regime is still in power. And just because a regime has collapsed doesn't mean whatever it was doing before collapsing was a source of its fragility. Firms, organizations, and political systems, they can persist with very little efficiency, actually, and they can collapse without losing efficiency. So in other words, just because you're efficient doesn't mean you're going to last, and just because you last doesn't mean you're doing the right thing for yourself.
Right.
I am sitting here just fine talking to you, right, despite my self-sabotaging TV binging behavior.
And, well, what did you watch?
Alone. We've talked about this show before.
Oh my gosh. Oh, you were addicted to that show.
Yes,
that's the survival show?
Yes, yes. Okay.
So it actually does have some bearing on this because it is about, you know, survival.
It is about survival. So it's also debatable whether the authoritarian regime's operating logic is simply to stay in power, as if ideology doesn't matter, as if who's in the government doesn't matter, as if the time of the year doesn't matter. So if I told you that Kaiser, your main goal was to make sure your podcast survives, it wouldn't be wrong exactly, but also it wouldn't tell us why you feature certain people on your podcast, but not others who might get you more listeners, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously my ideology matters. Otherwise, I'd have all sorts of popular China hawks on, which I'll never, 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 never do.
So does the CCP worry about staying in power? Surely, after 1989, it carefully studied the fall of the Soviet Union and pinpointed a few mistakes for the party to avoid. Mao did the same thing with the Taiping Rebellion in the mid-19th century. Well, the Taiping Rebellion was in the mid-19th century. Mao did it afterwards. Yeah. So he said that the Taiping failed because movement leaders got arrogant and Christianity was not suitable for the Chinese. And of course, Mao wants to stay in power, but he didn't launch the Great Leap Forward to stay in power.
Yeah, he launched it for other equally stupid reasons.
And lastly, if I could just add a addendum or perhaps a third feature or 2.5 feature of authoritarian teleology, it is the word strategy. So everything the government does might be described as a strategy, which is a part of some grand strategy. And this Machiavellian image of the Chinese state is simply inaccurate. I've observed the Chinese government closely in my research, and believe it or not, a lot of times they don't know what they're doing. Sometimes they make good decisions, other times they make bad decisions, and they usually don't think ahead three steps down the game tree. So does the CCP want to stay in power? Of course, but is it preoccupied with staying in power on a day-to-day basis? My answer is no.
Isa, I don't know if you remember, but a few months ago, I tweeted something and tagged you in it because it was just so funny. Just watching authoritarian teleology at work, I wrote, for the last couple of years, it's been Xi Jinping uses tough rhetoric on America because he knows that only by stoking nationalism can he remain in power, which is his one and only move. And today it's Xi Jinping uses conciliatory language with America. This is around the time of the San Francisco summit. Xi Jinping uses conciliatory language with America because he knows that only by offering an olive branch and appearing to desire stability in the bilateral relationship can he remain in power, which is his one and only move.
Yeah, that's a very good example.
It was so funny because the turnaround was so quick. Two completely opposite sides, bellicose or peace-loving, but always in the service of
state. Schrodinger's Xi Jinping or Schrodinger's power.
Oh, my God. Yeah, see, I said, once you said it, I saw it just everywhere. But how did this insight first come to you? How did you start questioning something that, let's face it, it's almost foundational, to political science. It's almost like this assumption that that's what political science is all about. It's just like there's this assumption that political actors do what they do so they can remain political actors. They stay in power. It's very much like, in economics, the kind of rational actor model is so foundational. Now it's been challenged, but not so much in political science. How did this come to you?
I think this feeling that something was off with this survival assumption first came to me when I was writing my book, The Performative State, which was based on my PhD dissertation. When I was working on my dissertation, I felt that I had to hitch my observation to something everybody agrees to be important, a big question that yields a big answer. I think every grad student knows what I'm talking about. So I was working on environmental governance in China, and I found that street-level bureaucrats were engaging in performative governance. They were acting like they care about solving environmental problems without actually substantively solving environmental problems, because they simply could. The Chinese EPA at the time was very weak. But just describing this phenomenon wasn't enough. I felt I'm a political scientist and I must tell a causal story. So then I went on to show that performative governance contributes to citizen satisfaction. People give the government credit for going through the motions with apparent sincerity. And I gave my theory a name, performative legitimacy. As I worked on converting my dissertation into a book, I had a feeling that this theory of performative legitimacy was a little too tidy. So the CCP wants legitimacy, so they engage in performative governance, and then surprise, surprise, they get legitimacy, and legitimacy helps with survival. But reality was not that simple. Performative governance was not a grand strategy. It was a bureaucratic coping mechanism. And just because some citizens buy it, it doesn't mean that's where the regime's legitimacy comes from.
Right.
My thinking was too infected by functionalism at the time. And I also remember writing down the word strategy. and felt that something was not entirely right, but I, at the time, didn't really know how to think outside the paradigm. I still don't think I know fully how to do that, but I eventually dropped this legitimacy framing from the book and also dropped this theory of performative legitimacy from the book. And I believe as social scientists, it is equally important for us to show when things don't work, when behavior doesn't realize in its intended function, when behavior results in the opposite of its intention, because that's the real world. And most people and most regimes in the real world fail at maximizing their utility. And again, this doesn't mean that they cannot last.
Right. So just to clear up a little bit of potential confusion here, often people in the China field hear this phrase, performance legitimacy. And that should not be confused with what you used to call performative legitimacy, or the English concept.
Right.
So performance legitimacy is this idea that China's or any government's legitimacy somehow derives from its success in addressing problems, in raising, you know, wealth and living standards, in providing goods and services, blah, blah, blah. Right. So it's a different thing from performative, which is the sort of play act. We know what performative means, right? Anyway, great, yeah. So you ended up having to completely rewrite then. I mean, was it a big surgical procedure to like extirpate that kind of teleological functionalist thinking?
Oh, it's hard. I'm still in the process of doing that. And sometimes functionalism is helpful. I can't completely rule it out, but I think now I'm more careful with the way I think about authoritarian regimes and also about democracies.
Yeah. And we'll get into a lot of that, but maybe first let's offer a little context for why you think this tendency in thinking has become so common when it comes to China. You suggested to me when we were chatting about this, I think it was in Boston last year, that it has everything to do with a kind of fixation on the problem of authoritarian resilience. I mean, I've talked about this on the show before. I've talked about the whole, I've said, for example, X book is another contribution to the growing literature on authoritarian resilience. And, that didn't sit wrong with me at the time, but, after talking to you, I've come to wonder about this. Could you talk a little bit about how this came about? What some of the major inflection points were in this whole discourse on authoritarian resilience, and maybe, who first started framing the question in terms of the puzzling longevity of the Chinese political system?
Authoritarian resilience was the master puzzle when I was going to grad school, and the question... Right, the puzzle is how and why do authoritarian regimes stay in power? So at first, I genuinely could not understand why the question was interesting. I knew I was supposed to be interested because the literature tells you to be interested, but I couldn't get physically excited about it. I didn't find the question interesting or exciting at a basic intuitive level. I think a part of the reason is that I grew up in China, and for me, the regime was just there. And you never scratch your head and ask, why is it there? It just is, right? Why hasn't it ended? Well, it doesn't, And it's sort of like why Americans are never going to find the resilience of the Electoral College the biggest puzzle in the world, right?
They will if once again the majority votes for Biden and somehow Trump wins, right?
Fair enough. So eventually I realized that authoritarian resilience was interesting or supposed to be interesting because authoritarian regimes were not supposed to last in the first place. Now, this belief has some empirical basis. After the Second World War and decolonization, the number of democracies around the world has been steadily increasing, but the number of countries around the world have been increasing, but also the percentage of democracies around the world has also been increasing since the mid-70s. So assuming the general trend is democratization, and because democracy is the end of history,
as we all know,
it makes sense to investigate why some regimes are resistant to democratization. This, of course, also serves America's foreign policy purposes. And of course, the fact that the Soviet Union fell apart, but the PRC didn't, made this more puzzling because they're both communists and because they're both communists, they should share similar faiths.
Right.
But I think a more fundamental assumption here is normative. The normative assumption is that because authoritarian regimes do bad things, they must be hated by their citizens who can't wait to overthrow the regime. And that's why the regime's mere existence is called survival, and why the survival is puzzling. And I have to emphasize the word survival here again, because it's a common word in the literature, and the things authoritarian regimes do are often called survival strategies or survival tactics. Usually, we don't bother to show that the actual behavior is an actual strategy or a tactic. We just assume that. So repression is a survival tactic, but sometimes recycling is also a survival tactic. So assuming everything the authoritarian government does under this bundle of survival tactics is basically authoritarian teleology at work.
Right. Thus, the commonplace question I've said many times, the quintessential American question is, why don't you hate your government as much as I think you should?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So in our conversations, you've put your finger on, I think, a really problematic assumption that's at the core of this puzzle that so many scholars have been wrestling with, and maybe even before this so-called puzzle of resilience came along. And it's not just scholars, because I think in the West, this is quite widely held among ordinary people too. Again, the why don't you hate your government as much as I think you should? That is this assumption that liberal democratic regimes are the only ones that possess real legitimacy, right?
It's interesting that you said real legitimacy, and it implies that there might be fake legitimacy. And yes, indeed, when we use the word legitimacy, we can mean two very different things. The first is normative legitimacy, I think what you mean by real legitimacy. And this kind of legitimacy can only be determined by moral philosophical arguments. So in other words, the judges of this legitimacy are philosophers like us, and that's real legitimacy. And there is a second very different way the word legitimacy is used, is to refer to perceived legitimacy, or sometimes called Weberian legitimacy. A regime is, in this case, legitimate if people live in this regime believe that it's legitimate. So the judge of legitimacy here is the people. Mm-hmm. So if North Koreans genuinely love the regime, then the regime can be said to be legitimate, regardless of whether we think the regime is legitimate or not. And some have argued that because there is no way to measure whether people truly love the regime or not in an authoritarian context, it doesn't make sense to talk about authoritarian legitimacy, and legitimacy here is therefore fake.
Right, it's the result of preference falsification. Right?
Exactly. But in our struggle to understand public opinion in authoritarian regimes, a curious binary emerges that corresponds to the binary of real versus fake legitimacy. So on one hand, there is this authoritarian citizen who, like you said, doesn't hate their government as much as you think they should. Why? Well, they're brainwashed by propaganda, or they're bought off by economic development.
How many times have I heard that? Oh my God.
On the other hand, there is the citizen who pretends to love the regime, but actually hates it. So we have this double image of an authoritarian citizen who is simultaneously a loyalist and a dissident, a sufferer of authoritarian personality on one hand, and a secret agent of democratic change on the other.
So well put.
And this binary then in turn translates into our posture toward people living in authoritarian regimes. So the first view says that authoritarian citizens don't deserve the horrible government they get and must be liberated from the tyrannical regime they're stuck in. And the second view says that authoritarian citizens deserve exactly what they get, and they must be treated as complicit. And this is why in our public discourse today, Chinese citizens are either victims of an oppressive government in need of enlightenment, or they're conspirators in this 100-year marathon to impose a authoritarian order on the world and to replace America as number one. And similarly, Russians, they are either forced by Putin into this war they absolutely strongly oppose, or they are willing partners in this nationalist crime that they've been waiting to commit since the day the Soviet Union fell apart. And those visions are totally incompatible with each other, yet they coexist.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my God. I mean, you've nailed it. You completely nailed it. So my sense, though, is that this fixation has only really increased in very recent years, especially as the Biden administration has drawn the distinction so, well, aggressively, you know, between democracy and authoritarianism. They have these democracy summits where, you know, some get invited and some don't. They frame the whole competition with China in terms of democracy versus authoritarianism, all of that. But you've challenged the idea, and you know, so have I, that authoritarianism is really an ideology at all. I mean, Marxism, sure, that is, and, you know, there is a text. There are many texts of Marxism. About Maoism, sure, that is an ideology. Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era is a mouthful, but it is also an ideology. Not authoritarianism, though. There isn't a text of authoritarianism. What makes it not an ideology in your mind?
Exactly. Authoritarianism is treated as if ideology in our thinking, but it's really just a descriptive category we scholars and then politicians use to describe countries like China, Vietnam, Russia, Zimbabwe, what have you. And none of these countries, last time I checked at least, has called itself authoritarian. And last time I checked, China calls itself a democracy. The word democracy, 民主, is on every street corner amongst the 12 core socialist principles in street art propaganda. And by the way, when the CCP says it is a people's democratic dictatorship, it's not admitting that it is a dictatorship in the social scientific sense. So is China a democracy? No, definitely not. Not in our definition.
Sure.
But does that mean China is championing and promoting the idea of authoritarianism and all the repression that comes with it as a desirable feature of a political system? No.
So Marxism is an ideology. Maoism is an ideology. Liberalism, that's an ideology, mm-hmm. not authoritarianism.
No.
So I'm sure, Isa, you often get asked about this claim you hear more and more that China has, you know, a model, right? It might not be authoritarianism per se, but it has like this developmental model, a Beijing consensus that, you know, it juxtaposes with a so-called Washington consensus and tries to push out into the world. What do you make of that claim? I remember we talked about this in Salzburg. You were on a panel that asked, is China promoting its model? So what do you think?
That's a very important question. Let me begin with this question. Does China think it has a model that is different from the West?
Sure.
Yes. Does China want a model that is different from the West? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But is the China model trying to replace the Western liberal model in the world? My answer is no, not yet at least. The China model in the eyes of the CCP is a model that is uniquely suited for the Chinese people and not a universal model to be introduced around the world. And this is what distinguishes the CCP's political philosophy from more universalist philosophies in the European tradition. And one of the goals of Western philosophy is to come up with a model that works not just for the people in Europe or America, but for all God's children. And there is a strong Judeo-Christian impulse to proselytize democracy around the world. And this is why democracy promotion is a full-blown industry, right? American students spend their gap years traveling to remote places around the world to do election monitoring. Many of them then go on to get their PhDs in comparative politics and become an expert of the region, the country they did election monitoring.
Right.
So I joked in Salzburg that Chinese students are not taking a gap year to do repression monitoring abroad in Cambodia, let's say, right? They're not. And, you know, China has not been actively spreading autocracy around the world as some democracy promoters fear. The China model, be it political or economic, is a reactive response to Western universalism, to the Washington consensus, if you will. It is, as of now, tailored for the Chinese people.
This is exactly what I say. Usually I frame it in terms of, you know, Western exceptional or American exceptionalism and Chinese exceptionalism. There's the universalist proselytizing form that says, you know, all our values and institutions are, you know, true for all people in all times, should be, you know, spread around the world as the gospel. But China's is so particularist. In fact, I always add that, you know, these are equally arrogant in a sense. But yeah, it's interesting that you come at it from the exact, you know, you come to the same conclusion, but not talking about the exceptionalism, but just sort of the political theory foundations of each. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I think a great example was the show When Marx Met Confucius, which you and Rana talked about on his episode Salzburg. It's become the butt of jokes on Twitter, but the audience of When Marx Met Confucius is not Americans or Russians or Indians or Indonesians. It is Chinese. What the CCP has been doing for the past century is to figure out a Chinese solution to Chinese problems. And this is why they broke up with the Comintern early on. Right. And this is why they are rejecting Western liberalism now. They don't believe in universalism. But of course, this is ironic in the sense that their own behavior internally shows that they at least believe in a version of universalism within China for all its ethnicities.
Yeah, that is ironic.
And now, interestingly, Xi Jinping has started to use the phrase common destiny for mankind. So we shouldn't foreclose the possibility that Chinese thinking might turn universalist in the future. I think this is only the beginning of a very, very interesting conversation. And who knows what the future holds?
Right. We're looking at these, you know, the global, you know, initiatives, the three global initiatives that she's been pushing. Yeah. I mean, but I think it's good that you caveated it and said, at least not yet, right? So tying together a couple of things that we've talked about just over the last few months, you see this impulse in Western political philosophy to come up with models that have universal applicability. They are not interested in our, you know, particularist philosophies, moral or political, or even maybe even aesthetic. You think that this has, as you said just now, Judeo-Christian roots, probably Greek, you know, sort of Greco-Roman philosophical roots as well. Do you think that the current drive in Western political science toward, you know, universalizability, is that the right word? Toward, you know, universal claims about, you know, politics, does that grow out of the same rootstock?
Maybe. Jeremy Manchik at Boston University has a fascinating paper on the Protestant spirit of political science. He's also been writing about the missionary impulse in American foreign policy. I think it's an interesting idea to connect the search for generalizability with religion. But I think it also has something to do with scientism.
Huh.
Just like the sciences and the natural sciences, I mean, and their search for the theory of everything. The holy grail of social science has been to find the general theory of human behavior for the past few decades.
Right.
The problem with searching for these general laws of human behavior is that humans are mischievous and they don't like to be predictable. So any law that we uncover will first and foremost see its violation by the subject itself.
Huh.
And I'm fascinated by this debate also in the natural sciences about whether the theory of everything exists, and even if it does, should the search for it be the primary goal of the sciences? Many physicists say yes, because physics is kind of the economics of the natural sciences,
right,
and biology is kind of their area studies. So physicists like Steven Weinberg, the Nobel laureate, they don't think it's as important to, let's say, discover new species of butterflies, and all our resources should be poured into theoretical physics. So it's a very, very interesting conversation, parallel conversation that's happening in the so-called hard sciences. But as a social scientist, my only hope is that generalizability does not monopolize our attention, because if scholars feel pressure to produce general theories. They will only look at questions suitable for general answers, and they will claim their theory to be general when it is not. That's what's counterproductive.
Yeah, I'm going to suppress my urge to ask you to go on with your analogies between the natural and social sciences. That's pretty funny. How'd you come up with so economics, you think, is the physics?
And, they all have their chain of contempt. In Chinese, it's 鄙视链, right? So economics is at the top of the social science hierarchy, but then they have what they call physics envy, right? They're the leader of social sciences, but they're not the natural sciences, so they have physics envy. But the same chain of contempt also exists in the natural sciences, and you see similar discussions and debates going on. So it's really interesting.
Curious where political science ranks.
I think regardless of how I rank political science, I'm going to get in trouble. But my hypothesis is that it's below economics, above sociology, which is above history, which is above anthropology. I don't know. I think I think people are going to get mad, so I should stop.
Okay. So, I mean, at some level, it strikes me that you are just taking on the very idea of generalizability as a goal. I mean, you are. You know, it's getting at some of the deep pathologies of Western social science. What is, if the right goal is not the search for the Holy Grail of, generalizability, what then should it be? I mean, if we're not chasing these ironclad laws of politics or whatever of human behavior, do we just throw up our hands and say everything is totally sui generis? I mean, there are no hard and fast rules. I mean, how do we keep from just sliding down the slope into total relativism then?
Well, I think the goal is to say things are sui generis when they are sui generis and say things are universal when they are universal. But if somebody says something is sui generis, let's not punish them for that. I think generalizability is a very good goal, but it shouldn't be our only goal. It shouldn't be the holy grail, especially when we still know so little about this fast, diverse world and its myriad cultures, languages, and histories. Let's stop asking questions like, why China to somebody who studies China, or why Turkey to somebody who studies Turkey. These questions imply that knowledge about Turkey or China is not as valuable or universal as knowledge about America or Americans. A good liberal should not make those assumptions.
Right, of course not.
And very, very, very importantly, we also need to recognize that what is sui generis and what is universal are also in the eyes of the beholder. An example I really like to use is Irvin Goffman's classic book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. It's hugely influential. And Goffman in the book argues, and just to quickly summarize, that when people interact with each other daily, they put on this front stage trying to control the other's impression of them. So we all want to be liked by other people. So we have a front stage, and then we have a backstage where we can be ourselves, right?
Right.
So everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but the book is very, very influential and powerful. It's a really great book. But very few people, right? A lot less people can actually remember where the study was conducted. Well, the study was based on observations of residents of the Shetland Islands in Scotland. So Goffman was very open and clear that the study was based on the Shetland Islands, and he never said in the book that he was producing a generalizable theory of human behavior, partly because the book was written in the 50s and there was no need to do that back then. But his theory is remembered as one of general human behavior. Why? Because it was based on evidence from a European country. Now, imagine that the same theory is produced in China with the Shetland Islands, all the times that he mentioned the location, replaced with Hainan Island, and keep every other word the same in the book.
Right.
Will this book be read as a book about people in general?
No.
Or will this be read as a book about Chinese people? I think the latter, right?
Yeah. It would be on the China shelf. Yeah, for sure.
Yes. And my guess is that this will be known as a book about how Chinese people love face. So to answer your question about goals, the goal is twofold. First, to not obsess over generality or generalizability or universality, right? All the iterations of the same word. It's okay to think about it for those who want to think about it, but don't obsess over it.
Yeah. No, that's sound advice.
And the second goal is also to recognize that what's perceived as general and what's perceived as too generous is a function of our strong human biases, and we should try to correct those biases when we see them, especially when we see them in ourselves.
Well, you said that about Goffman's book. I was reminded of, I think this is something that I hope everyone knows now, how in recent years we've realized that almost every major study of psychology, all of these really foundational studies, they were all conducted on like these 18 to 21-year-old white university students. So, you know, they're like as weird as it gets, right? Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, right? Hardly the stuff of generalizability, but you never notice when it's white people, right? Yeah, that's nuts, man. So I suppose my hope has always been at least that we could, you know, try to understand a given society or polity in the terms that it understands itself, right? Mm-hmm, to really focus on trying for, you know, deeper, again, cognitive empathy,
yes.
Right? But again, isn't there a risk of slipping down into relativism with
it? Oh, yeah. There's always a risk of going too far toward anything, universalism or relativism. But the question is, what exactly are we lacking now? Where is the pendulum now? I suppose most of us who study foreign countries all have a baby relativist in us, right?
Yeah.
We learn the language, we learn the culture, the history, and we try to think like them. I hope we still try. When we take this to an extreme, we can obviously venture into the land of cultural essentialism and cultural determinism. And that's not good. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
You mean the baby relativist in each of us?
Yes.
Okay.
So cognitive empathy is still good. Verstehen is still good. It's important.
What's that word? Verstehen?
Verstehen.
What does that mean?
It means to understand in German.
And it's
Weber's term for cognitive empathy to some.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I got a new word. Yeah. Cool. All right.
So, yeah, I think perhaps in this polarized world we live in, we could all use a little more cognitive empathy, like you said, Kaiser, and not just between the Chinese and the Americans, but also between the Republicans and the Democrats and between the younger and older generations. And how can we solve a problem peacefully, if we want to solve the problem peacefully, without understanding where the other side comes from?
Exactly. Yay, cognitive empathy. I can't believe you're like touting my favorite concept. So Isa, you know, we've talked quite a bit about sort of, you know, the problems in approaches to social science. Let's talk about the state of the China field then. I mean, when I've gone out there and I've, you know, made the case for area studies as opposed to disciplines, when I've decried the tendency recently, you know, to see every damn thing through the lens of national security, and this is a problem both, I have to say, in the US and in China. Pan-securitization is definitely a problem in China as well. But when I've criticized these approaches, everyone agrees. Everyone says, I mean, nobody says, oh, no, we should, you know, stick to the disciplines and no one else has anything important to add. Oh, they all agree. But still, why do the area studies still get treated like the redheaded stepchild in the academy? I mean, why is the funding doesn't go? I mean, at best, they'll have a center where there's a sort of lackadaisical interdisciplinary cooperation. There's not, you know, it's like if I graduate and I have a PhD in East Asian studies, my odds on the job market are pretty terrible, right?
Yeah, if you graduate with a PhD, your odds on the job market,
okay,
your
okay.
job on the odds market, I don't know.
But
I
even
know.
Worse it's, than it's, if you're in like, you know.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. It's a great question. The answer, Kaiser, lies in my book.
Oh, good.
Sometimes people look like they agree with you. That doesn't mean they actually agree with you. So jokes aside, I think the cause for the decline of area studies is very structural. So one good thing the American government did during the Cold War was to pour copious resources into training people with area expertise.
Right.
The goal was to understand the enemy so as to convert them. But of course, we can't explain the effect of this investment through its main goal to convert the enemy. Otherwise, we would be engaging in functionalism. This investment in area studies resulted in the production of abundant knowledge and interest within the United States about China, about Russia, about Vietnam, etc. And now the Cold War is over. Investment in area studies declined precipitously. Now, academic departments rarely conduct searches in, say, Chinese politics or Russian politics. Some still do, but most don't. And there are less and less jobs, particularly on studies of a single country. And students, therefore, are forced to make their dissertations appear quote-unquote general and make sure they send the signal that they're not a mere area studies person. So the Marxist explanation for the decline of area studies is money.
And you are a Neiman Marxist after all.
I am a Neiman Marxist after all. There's also a Weberian explanation. The Weberian explanation is the bureaucratization and industrialization of academia, which have the benefit of productivity, but also results in synchronization in the ways knowledge is produced. There is also a psychological explanation.
Wait, I don't get that. Wait, that was like too over my head. Okay, so the Weberian explanation is, you said bureaucratization and industrial. Can you unpack that a bit?
Bureaucratization of academia means the increasing functionalization, division of labor, value for expertise, and so on and so forth, right?
That's why, like, what we study is narrower in time, narrower geographically.
Exactly.
Like, it can't be too narrow. It's like, yeah.
Super. Yeah, and then the production of knowledge sometimes could look a little assembly liney. The patterns of knowledge production start to kind of mimic each other, which can result in great efficiency, just like in during industrialization, right? It results in more productivity.
So do you favor the Weberian explanation more or the Marxist one?
Well, there's a third one.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so there is also a psychological theory, right? So it goes back to our biases and our biases that attribute everything to culture. So during the Cold War, the answer to why the Russians and Chinese didn't mind their totalitarian regimes was that the Russians were alcoholics and the Chinese were beaten as children. And that's old school Orientalism, and we want to avoid that. I think we know by now.
There a book about like Japanese toilet training or something like
that? I did not know that, actually. So we need to stop seeing the Chinese, the Russians, the Mongolians, the Japanese as exotic, right?
Right.
It's very good that we're now saying they're just like us, but as we recognize that they're just like us, right? And saying they're just like us is to say that, you know, area studies sometimes can go too far on cultural essentialism, right? We have to recognize that individuals fundamentally, human beings, share similarities and similar psychologies and similar impulses and so on and so forth, right? Entirely correct. But as we recognize that they're just like us, we also need to make sure that it's not a glorified version of us, which is this ideotypical liberal subject who goes about their daily life defending democracy, right? So that's kind of the glorified version of the liberal subject. I think we have to recognize that they're just like the normal us, the flawed us, right? So not this ideotypical us. And once we find this right balance, and we will realize, I think, that the supposed dichotomy between general knowledge and area studies is really a false one. So we don't have to choose either or.
Even though I didn't ask you this question that I typically ask people, I've asked so many people on this show already, you've actually provided inadvertently the best answer to that question that I didn't ask you. That question typically is like, when it's so obvious to us that Chinese people or, you know, any other people have certain national or cultural attributes. And I mean, that history has had a profound, you know, impact on shaping their own cognition, their own norms, their own, you know, habits of mind. And how do you work that in without you know, engaging in essentialism? At the same time, it's also blindingly obvious that they're very much like us, right? So I think your approach to this is a really good one, and I think it's one I hope that people will kind of keep in mind, because this is something that we all encounter daily. I mean, I encounter this every day.
Yeah, and it's really hard. I still don't think I can do it. It's, you know, it's very 矛盾, right? It's how do you kind of balance the two? It's difficult, and we just have to try.
Yeah, well, I hope we all try in your fashion. Isa, I want to ask you about this, because, you know, I don't know whether you heard this interview that I did with Peter Hessler a couple of months ago. I asked him what he really thought needed to be fixed in sort of academic China scholarship. And he actually had a really simple answer, which was they need to write better.
Hmm.
And one thing look, I haven't finished reading The Performative State. So I've read part of it. I really do hope a paperback comes out. But anyway, one thing that really struck me about it is the writing. I mean, you write exceptionally well. You write with clarity, but you also write with really kind of fun diction, at least. I mean, more than that, you can tell you enjoy writing. You turn a fun phrase. And because of that, it's quite enjoyable to read. But also, you know, what you do is still just unmistakably scholarly and very valuable. You know, it's got theory, it's got extensive field work, it's got lots of data. I don't think it's a coincidence that you are also a person who I discovered, you know, in our long conversation on the train and so forth, that you are extraordinarily well-read. You read a lot, and half the time that we chat, it's about a novel or about short stories or some, you know, work of fiction. Do you have some words of advice for graduate students right now? A lot of, I know, the listeners are graduates or undergraduates who are, you know, wanting to develop themselves as better writers. What's your secret?
Thank you, Kaiser, for the compliment. I appreciate it. I don't know how well I write, but I certainly put a lot of time into it. So I'm not a native speaker. And when I was first exposed to the academic literature, I found a lot of it hard to digest.
Native speakers do too.
Okay. Yeah, so at first I thought it was because my English was not good. And, you know, I'm Chinese, we always blame ourselves first, right?
Right.
Is that a thing?
That's essentialist.
Okay, yeah, that's essentialist, take it back. But eventually I realized it was not my English. My English is just fine. It's just that academic writing sometimes can be pretty bad. And there are some very, very good writers in academia, but in general, it's obviously not the same quality as fiction, even science fiction.
Right.
So when I realized that, I felt a little gaslit. And now I see it as my own responsibility to make sure that I am as plain-spoken as possible in my writing so my readers can at least understand my sentences. They don't have to agree with me, of course, but hopefully they will know what I'm talking about at least. Some might say that academic writing should be bad because it's science, it's not poetry. So unless you sound like a robot, you're not a scientist. Well, I don't agree with that. George Orwell wrote about this in his essay, Politics and the English Language. He says, good writing is not just good writing, it's good thinking. Clear writing is clear thinking. I think the essay was written in 1942 or something. I think it still applies today. C. Wright Mills has also written about this. A lot of the times, academic writing, Mills says, is intentionally obtuse and vague and jargony so as to appear scientific and erudite. But if you really know what you're saying, you shouldn't need to hide behind those terms. You should be as clear as possible so people who want to engage with you know exactly what they're engaging with.
Amen. And yeah, absolutely.
Now, I'm not saying I do this well. I don't do it well enough, but we should at least try. And I So I urge my students to try. And of course, the only way to good writing is to read good writing. So I encourage students to not give up reading non-academic work, fiction, science fiction, or even good scientific writers like Carlo Rovelli, the Italian physicist, who's written a couple of books that are Amazon bestsellers, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have to check him out. That's great. Speaking of recommendations like that, we will move on to recommendations. But first, Isa, thank you so much. What a delight to finally have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's just, it's always so good to talk to you. And hopefully this will give people just some sense of the way your mind works. And I'm going to finish your book, have you back on. We'll talk specifically about environmental governance in China of 2013 and then the performative state. It's great to connect with you. And again, thank you for having me out here in Chicago. Let me give a quick shout out to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Center for East Asian Studies there, CEAS. They have generously helped me out this year, making it possible for me to continue to do the work of Seneca after the untimely demise of the China Project. So thanks once again to CEAS at Wisconsin. All right, let's move on to recommendations. I am dying to know what you have to recommend, Isa. What do you have?
I'm going to recommend the last book I read. It's called The Wife of Bath.
Like the Chaucer Wife of Bath.
Like the Chaucer Wife of Bath. It's written by Marion Turner, who is the J.R.R. Tolkien Professor at Oxford. Isn't that
there
the
is a best? J.R.
Yes, there is.
That's awesome.
Isn't that the best academic title ever? The J.R.R. Tolkien Professor?
Oh my God.
I know. I'm so jealous. So I started reading this book because I saw it in the bookstore. And the cover just grabbed me. It's a beautiful, striking cover. Almost doesn't look like an academic book, but it is.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So The Wife of Bath is an analysis of this key literary figure, the Wife of Bath, in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. She is this average woman, a middle-aged woman, who defies all the existing stereotypes of woman. So women in the English literature are either young and pure, like Snow White or Luo Ji's girlfriend in The Three-Body Problem, or they're old and evil, like Snow White's stepmother. So the Wife of Bath, Alison, she's real, she's a normal woman, a middle-aged woman, a working woman in medieval Europe, and she's also a victim of patriarchy, but she doesn't dwell on self-pity, and she just keeps on going and does her thing. So for all those ways she defies stereotypes, she's both loved and loathed. Mm. She and her doppelgangers repeatedly emerge in the English literature in the centuries to come. It's a book about female identity, and it's a great read.
Oh, excellent. Disappointed to learn that it was an academic book, but
it's an academic book also for a popular audience.
Okay, cool. Great. I am not going to recommend literature this time. I'm going to recommend a guitarist named Kent Nishimura. He is a wunderkind on the instrument. He plays acoustic guitar, an absolute musical genius. He has taken just a great repertoire of sort of classic songs from pop, from rock, from soul, from jazz, and a bunch of other genres. And he's created these just astonishing arrangements that really capture all the chords. I mean, the complexities of all the chords, the vocal melodies, the instrumental solos, all the little flourishes that, you know, are kind of the hooks of the songs. And maybe most importantly, he sets it all to a killer bass groove. I mean, all is just with six strings. You have to not just hear it, you actually have to see this guy to believe it, because he's this baby-faced Japanese guy in his early 20s tops. And just the amount of groove and pocket in his playing, it's wonderful, because it flies in the face of those East Asiatic stereotypes of, you know, mechanical playing. The guy is so soulful. It's unbelievable. So check him out on YouTube. He has these like studio quality recordings of him playing on YouTube. Just so three songs I would suggest you start with are the 80s Tears for Fears classic, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. Check out the Stevie Wonder song, Sir Duke. Everyone knows that. And then the Police song, Every Little Thing She Does is Magic, because these are all great. They're great songs, but also the arrangements are so, so magical. But then after you've seen those three, you'll be totally mind blown by his rendition of Hey 19, the Steely Dan song from the album Gaucho, which is, oh my God, you'll just die. So clever, so clever. The versatility, the groove, the technical mastery, it is all there. Once again, Iza, thank you so much. Okay, again, the guy's name is Kent Nishimura. Thank you so much, Iza. Oh my God, what a pleasure.
Thank you. It's always fun to chat with you.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're going to go get some fish now, right?
Yeah, some hot oil fish, shui zhu yu, that Michelle recommends.
I'm very psyched. And if that turns out to be really as good as I think it's going to, that may be my recommendation for next week. Thanks, Iza.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Seneca Podcast. The show is produced, recorded, engineered, edited, and mastered by me, Kaiser Guo. Support the show through Substack at seneca.substack.com, where there is a growing offering of terrific original China-related writing and audio. Or email me at senecapod@gmail.com if you have ideas on how you can help out. And don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Enormous gratitude to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for East Asian Studies for supporting the show this year. Thanks once again to my wonderful guest, Iza Ding. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.